In this campaign season, we're likely to hear about life inside the White House. Our guest today, one of the very few in a position to do so, and he'll be talking about life after the White House. With us in Dallas, the 43rd President of the United States of America, George W. Bush. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. In 1994, George W. Bush was elected 46th governor of Texas. 4 years later, he was re-elected with a record 69% of the vote. In 2000, Mr. Bush was elected 43rd president of the United States. 4 years later, he won a second term. In November 2010, Mr. Bush published Decision Points, a book describing critical decisions in his personal life and his presidency. The same month, he hosted a groundbreaking ceremony for the George W. Bush Presidential Center, located on the campus of Southern Methodist University, just a few miles from where we're taping today. The George W. Bush Presidential Center is now nearing completion. Mr. President, first things first, 2 years in a row, your beloved Texas Rangers have gone to the series and come away without the commissioner's trophy.
Yes.
They're five games up in their division as you and I speak. Could this be the year?
This is the year, Peter. First of all, the fact that we got to the World Series was miraculous to many Ranger fans. But now that we're used to the World Series, Game 6 of last year still represents major heartbreak. I mean, it was one...
You were there, weren't you?
No, I wasn't there. I was there for the home games, but this was in St. Louis. And so Laura and I were in Crawford. And went to the game last night with Nolan Ryan, and it's still painful for both of us to relive the moment. But it was, listen, we had never experienced pennant fever in the Metroplex, and it was very exciting. Sadly lost to the Giants, who you're probably for, and then the Cardinals. And but nevertheless, it was really exciting.
This is the year.
This is the year.
This is here.
I don't know. We'll see.
Segment one, the afterlife.
Yeah.
While you were still in the White House, you write in Decision Points, Mrs. Bush began referring to your post-presidential years as the afterlife.
Right.
So here are a few model afterlives. John Quincy Adams leaves the White House, goes right back into public service,
right.
Serves in the House of Representatives. Bill Clinton, former President Clinton, places himself right in the media center of the world, New York City. On the other hand, you've got Harry Truman. He goes home to Independence, Missouri, sets himself up, totally satisfied being a prominent citizen of Independence, Missouri, and nothing else
right.
for the rest of his life. How did you think through what you wanted to accomplish in your afterlife?
Well, the other person who has served as a role model for me for a long time is George H.W. Bush, who famously said, once you leave the stage, you stay off the stage. And I thought long and hard about that. And decided that the not being on the stage was something I was comfortable with. I mean, Peter, there's really no sacrifice in serving the country, particularly if you love the country like I do. But if there is one, it's loss of anonymity, and to a certain extent, I'm trying to, or as best as I can, trying to regain it. Secondly, I think it's bad for the presidency to have former presidents bloviating, opining, or telling people how it ought to be done. So this is a rare occasion for me, and I'm thankful you're here. But I really don't want to be in the public eye anymore, and feel a certain sense of liberation not being out there.
You like it better.
I really do. I mean, look, 8 years was awesome, and I was famous and I was powerful, and but I have no desire for fame and power anymore. I don't want to undermine our president. Or whoever president, and a former president can do that. And I think it's bad for the presidency itself. And so I'm pretty content. The afterlife, really what she should have said was, we're now getting ready to start a new chapter in our life. Afterlife being the afterlife of the presidency, but afterlife kind of gives a sense that, you're like
something's
dead.
Over. Right.
And I have found that there's, life after the presidency is awesome.
Presidential libraries, again, a couple different models. The Reagan Library sits high on a hill in Southern California. Magnificent structure.
Yes.
Isolated,
yeah.
But magnificent. Then you've got your dad's library at Texas A&M, where he made a very conscious decision to include a teaching branch of his institution with three dozen very impressive fellows at the Bush School for Government and Public Policy, a grant awarding peace branch of Texas A&M. So it's integrated into the academic mission of the university. So how did you decide what you wanted for the Bush Center,
well, of course,
for your center?
You forgot to talk about the Hoover Institute. Widely admired, by the way, and by a lot of people, including me. So I wanted to figure out a way to remain engaged in policy. I wanted to defend certain principles without being involved with politics. And we just started the Hoover Model, which is a place of great intellectual depth. You know, obviously I'd worked with some, Eddie Lazier and Condi and...
John Cogan.
Yeah, Cogan and Taylor.
Right.
All of whom are really bright, smart people who contribute to the dialogue. On the other hand, we wanted to be different.
Will you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I mean that as a result of our kind of strategizing on certain issues and our defense of certain principles, there are tangible results, I mean meaningful results in people's lives being changed that we can point to. And so anyway, so I want to be involved with, for example, the defense of human freedom. It's a principle I believe is important. And I also thought we ought to be involved with higher education. I thought it'd add oomph to our programs. And so I began to look around, and SMU approached us. Laura went to SMU, Karen Hughes went to SMU, Harriet Myers went to SMU. So I knew a lot of people had gone to SMU. SMU happens to be located in the heart of Dallas. They've got an alumni base that is active and willing to spend money. They were willing to contribute 14 acres of land in the heart of Dallas. And as importantly, they were willing to negotiate a governance structure, which meant we were a part of SMU, but the course of the institute was not going to be determined by SMU.
Right.
And that's important.
Right.
And we studied the Hoover Model, by the way, to determine the degree of independence that one can achieve once you become associated with higher ed.
Last question before I want to go through these. You mentioned human freedom.
Right.
I want to go through a few of those. Last question. Undergrad at Yale, business school degree at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Baylor's closer to Crawford.
Yeah.
So SMU, well, there must have been a bidding process there.
A little slight. Baylor, yeah, they were in serious contention, but it turns out that SMU, for a variety of reasons, some of which I just outlined, right, became the ideal position. One of the things that makes us unique is that we are in the middle of a big city that's easy to access, and we've got pretty good convening power. So like when the Dalai Lama came down as a gift to the Bush Center, it was easy for him to get here. And so facility of travel also was a part of our consideration.
Right. Okay. Segment two, global health.
Yeah.
We'll take one of your big initiatives. The Bush Institute has so far committed itself to six initiatives. We probably won't have time to get through all six, but I'd like to talk about a few. Global health, education reform, economic growth, human freedom, military service, and a women's initiative.
Yeah.
Let's talk about global health. The Institute's Pink Ribbon, Red Ribbon program, and I'm quoting now from the Institute's website, quote, leveraging the President's emergency plan for AIDS relief established under President George W. Bush, which means we've got to step back and talk for a second about PEPFAR.
Yeah.
The President's emergency plan for AIDS relief. You enacted the program in 2003, committing the United States to spending $15 billion over 5 years, principally in Africa. And as best I can tell, you sit down today and Google around on PEPFAR, and what you get is a unanimous view that it worked.
Yeah.
According to a 2009 study, this is just one of many studies, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, in Africa, the program, PEPFAR, the program saved more than 1 million lives. How did you come to make that decision? This country had never done anything of that scope
correct
before.
So in life, you got to set priorities. I also believe that a principle worth defending, which we will defend at the Bush Center, is to whom much is given, much is required. I believe we're a blessed nation that is, therefore, have a sense of responsibility to the extent we can to help others. In this case, there was a pandemic destroying an entire generation of people. And I didn't see how I could be president of a powerful, the most powerful, and the richest nation, and not lend our support to saving lives. I mean, it would have been unconscionable not to act. And so I thought it was in our moral interest to act. I also knew it was in our national security interest to act. Much of my presidency, obviously, was affected by 9/11 and the ideological war that 9/11 represented. In other words, there's an ideological conflict.
Right.
And the enemy could only recruit and they find hopeless people. I thought it would be very difficult to find anybody more hopeless than a child who mother and dad died of AIDS and wealthy nations did nothing to help. And so I viewed it in our national security interest and our moral interest to put together a strategy that was not paternalistic like many AIDS programs, mm-hmm. but one based upon partnership and with a comprehensive strategy in most affected nations on the continent of Africa, and it worked. And for that, I'm grateful.
The Pink Ribbon, Red Ribbon program. Now we're talking about the Bush Institute's
yeah.
program to combat cervical and breast cancer. Specifically, the program aims to reduce deaths from cervical cancer in Africa by 24% in 5 years. By the way, what I just read is typical of the kind of thing you read in the Bush Institute yeah. website over and over. We have a specific aim. We intend to measure what we do. We
yeah.
intend to be time specific.
Yeah.
How will you build on the PEPFAR? Is this you're using relationships you've established in Africa?
Well, it's actually our ability to lay out a strategy. In other words, it's important for people to understand that many women who've got the AIDS virus also get the virus that causes cancer, and that it's not much to detect. In other words, all it requires is an effort. Secondly, we convinced the State Department to allow us to add the cervical cancer component to the AIDS component on the platforms that already exist.
So you're adding a test.
Adding
testing
a test.
Testing is already going on.
And thirdly, we've convinced drug companies and others to join us in a collaborative effort. We started very much like PEPFAR. We started with, starting with the most affected nations where we know leadership will step up. And so Zambia is where we started. First Lady of Zambia is very much involved with encouraging screening and helping develop an infrastructure, that enables women to be screened. About 15,000 or so women now have been screened in Zambia in the first couple of months of the program. So there's a lot of awareness is taking place. The idea is to go to, you know, three or four affected countries and hopefully spawn copycats. I mean, we don't need to be the author of every country, but we'd like to be the catalyst for others to say, wow, this initiative works. Therefore, let's join the joint venture the Bush Center's put together or let's copy what the joint venture's done. And what I tell people who've contributed to our institute is that 5 years from now, we'll be able to show you that thousands now live. And I challenge them by saying, do you think it's worth it? Does the human condition matter? One of the principles that we defend at the Bush Center is all life is precious. Now, that's very controversial in the political arena. It shouldn't be, but it is, because obviously it connotes all kinds of issues. But I think it's a principle that makes that helps define America in many ways.
You said you don't mind being a former president.
Yeah.
And yet when I hear you talk, you enjoy using what's left of you of the bully pulpit.
Well, I do to a certain extent, but
people listen to you because you're you. People will give money. You can energize this program because of what you
can. And one reason I think I can is because people realize it is apart from the political process.
Right.
You know, either you're in or out of politics, Peter, and I've chosen to be out. I mean, you can't be halfway. You know, and given the environment today with all the blogs and this, that, and the other, I mean, it's like, you know, I told... pretty unattractive metaphor, but I said I crawled out of the swamp and I'm not crawling back in. And you know, I'm interested in politics. I'm a supporter of Mitt Romney. I hope he does well, but you know, he can do well without me.
Last question on Africa. Let me quote to you Dambisa Moyo. Dambisa Moyo is a Zambian author, economist, trained at Goldman Sachs. And she's a little leery of the AIDS. Let me just give you the quotation. Yes, we can send HIV drugs to Africa, but are we creating an environment in Africa to make sure that in 10 years or 20 years, African governments are going to take responsibility for this? We Africans are not supposed to be tapping into the American tax base.
Yeah. She's probably right in the long run. In the short run, they needed to tap into the American base. They need somebody to pay for the antiretroviral drugs. Now, Africans are responsible for developing the infrastructure so the antiretrovirals make it, you know, beyond the reaches of the capital, for example. But one of the parts of the strategy in PEPFAR was to convince African governments to develop a strategy and the tactics that would work. And behind the U.S. effort is a infrastructure that's now developing by Africans. And so,
it's coming along.
Yeah, absolutely. But the question is, what would happen if the Americans didn't intervene? And therefore, by the way, the rest of the world following. And thousands, if not millions, would have died. And then you would have had a continent where an entire generation of people had been wiped out. And then you'd been dealing with a lot bigger problems.
Right. From an article earlier this month in the Dallas Morning News, quote, "At home, there's still no consensus about the record of George W. Bush. In Africa, he's a hero." I don't know how to ask this question without making it sound crass, but does it irk you that you and your administration don't get more credit? Doesn't bother you at all?
Look, my time as president is over. I did what I did. I wrote a book, and people are really interested to find out why I decided what I decided. They ought to read the book. But the debate's finished, and I think, you know, kind of striving for a legacy is a complete waste of time. I mean, a legacy will emerge with the reach of time, and I'm perfectly comfortable with with a couple of facts. One, I won't be around to read it. And two, that will be objective historians who properly analyze the decisions I made. And my book is just a way to contribute to the eventual writing of history. And I'm fine.
You look fine.
It is what it is.
Okay. Segment three, education reform. A couple of quotations. Quotation and a couple of statistics. Quotation, former First Lady Laura Bush, quote, "To build a more hopeful America, we must help our children reach as far as their vision and character can take them." Beautiful, close quote. Statistics. According to a Harvard study, last year American students ranked 17th in world reading and 32nd in math. And among African American, Hispanic, and Native American students, the figures were much worse.
Yeah.
What's wrong? What's wrong with America's schools?
They won't change. And one of the things, a principle of the Bush Center, is that we believe that you cannot have a free society without educated people, and that accountability is essential to freeing people from ignorance. So one of the reasons I got into politics in the first place is I was dissatisfied with the public schools of Texas. I tell people this story all the time about meeting a geography teacher in a high school outside of Houston. I said, "Man, it must be awesome to be a geography teacher." He said, "It's terrible." And I said, "Why?" I said, "Because my students can't read." So what has happened is they've just shuffled kids through the school without ever asking the question, do you have the knowledge necessary to move on? And this is the beginning of the basis of what is now called No Child Left Behind, which at the state level, we said, in order to get state funds, you have to measure. And then when I got to Washington, I said, in order to receive federal funds, 70% of the education budgets are federal money. It didn't bother me that it was only 7%. What bothered me is that we weren't getting a good return on our dollars invested. And so No Child Left Behind demands accountability. And it's interesting to watch accountability come under assault. You got people saying, "Don't measure me. It's unfair to hold me to account because of the social conditions of the students." And you've got people saying, "There is no role for government to demand accountability." I strongly disagree with both arguments. And the Bush Center In this case, right now, we're training principals to be able to use accountability better to enhance for change. And if you're a reformer, if you believe in reforming a system that won't change, that I believe that accountability is the gateway to reform. In other words, you got to have data. You got to prove failure before you can demand change. And so accountability is one of the key parts of demanding results-oriented processes.
Can I? No, child. I Googled around before coming down here to try to figure out. As I said, on PEPFAR, opinion is unanimous.
Yeah.
It worked.
Yeah.
Now, there's some carping about what was our national interest, but the notion that the drug money went over and people took it and over a million lives were saved.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees.
Yeah.
No child is not like that. I've got the column in the Wall Street Journal last year, quote, talked about, quote, dramatic progress, especially after No Child Left Behind. Well, that's one thing.
Yeah.
And then there's a Cato report of just a couple of months ago saying there's no pattern of faster improvement under No Child. In fourth grade, math improvements were faster before No Child than after. In eighth grade math, it's essentially a dead heat, and so forth. So it's a mixed picture.
Yeah.
All right. So we got that. And then I see the Bush Institute, your program for principals, is knitting together a network all over the country. So I was thinking, well, this looks decentralized. What the Institute is doing now looks decentralized. I may be overreading all this, but is
the
right?
You are.
I am.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the question is No Child, do you think now of No Child Left Behind as a worthy experiment that taught us the federal
government? No question about it. Not only that, it emphasizes decentralization. Okay. Nobody says, here's how you have to teach. The federal government wasn't saying, the state government wasn't saying, you must do this or that. What we were saying is, in return for money, could you please show us if the methodology you've chosen to use works? I mean, you quoted statistics saying that we're like 17th in the world in this. Yeah. And one reason is because we're not fixing problems early.
Right.
And how do you determine whether or not problems need to be fixed if you don't measure? And so, you know, believe me, teach the test, just I've dealt with all that all my public service career. I am absolutely adamant in my belief that a education reform only works if you prove failure or success. And the only way to prove failure or success is to measure. Now, when I got elected governor of Texas, you know, there are like 25 goals.
Too many.
Yeah. And so, you know, we distilled it down initially to like three or four goals, one of which was you have to read at grade level by the fourth grade. Now, if you want to improve the statistics that you just commented on, which I know you do, at the very beginning, you got to teach kids to read. Otherwise, you know, the future engineers don't exist.
Right.
And so, yeah, no, it's an absolutely worthy effort, and it needs to be defended.
Okay, so let me get your sense of where things stand right now. Way back when your dad was vice president, Reagan years, there was that famous report, A Nation at Risk.
Yeah.
And you know, my feeling, and my guess is it was to some extent your feeling too, because my guess is it was part of the impetus behind No Child Left Behind, was that not a whole lot happened from Ronald Reagan straight through to 2002 when you enacted that bill.
Correct.
20 years of not much happening. And now we've got your governor, your brother in Florida, voucher programs.
Yeah.
Mitch Daniels in Indiana, pretty sweeping voucher programs.
Yes.
Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, maybe the most sweeping voucher programs in the country.
Correct.
You've got that. At the same time, what we've got coming along, now I haven't seen test results, but you sure can identify the effort. You've got digital learning initiatives.
Absolutely.
From the Khan Academy online to these rocket ship schools out in my neck of the woods near San Jose to the News Corporation has just put $1 billion into K-12 digital education. Do you get the feeling that the country is maybe about to make a move?
I hope so, but in order for them to do so, they got to understand whether or not the schools are working or not. Listen, most people believe the school their child goes to is excellent.
Most people love their own congressman, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But in this case, what accountability does is it compares schools from district to district.
Oh, that's you've got on your website.
And then we've also got accountability from schools district to district to schools around the world.
Right.
And so my only, listen, this reform movement's awesome. I just happen to believe that when you take the guesswork out of whether or not a school is performing, it emboldens reformers. I mean, you got to have the case. And that's why accountability is important. And my judgment is that there's a kind of a status-oriented group of people. They just won't change. Mm-hmm. And what you're now describing is kind of beginning to kind of nibble at the edges.
Right.
And I never worried about the delivery system, the nature of the delivery system. You got to worry about the results of any delivery system. And so it's, if you focus on results and demand results and provide options for different delivery systems to get those results, that's what causes there to be change.
Right. I want to mention this because to me it's one of the most impressive things. Bush Institute already has a website, Global Report Card, all one word, globalreportcard.org. Anywhere in America, you can type in your address and compare the test scores in your school district with those in other school districts in your state, in the nation, and around the world.
That's right.
It's a very powerful
device. So you got a school
device.
District in suburban Dallas and that thinks they're doing great, and then all of a sudden you dial in relative math scores, you know, compared to Gutenberg, Sweden, or whatever it might be, and you realize, wow, my kids, you know, kind of the test scores for my kids at my high school don't even come close to comparing to. And so then the parent has a tool. Say, why aren't we comparing?
Right.
And why come we're, like, you know, stuck in mediocrity?
Right.
And but without the tool, it's guesswork. And people want to guess that their kids goes to a great school. So that's what accountability does.
Segment 4, economic growth and human freedom. The Bush Institute has embarked on a 4% growth project. You've already held a couple of conferences on growth already. And just to give folks some sense of how dramatic the aim of 4% growth is, last first quarter of this year, the United States grew at 1.9%. So the Bush Institute is arguing that the country could and should grow twice as fast as it is right now. Former President George W. Bush, speaking at one of these conferences, quote, most of the political debate is about our balance sheet, but in order to solve the balance sheet, you've got to grow the private sector, close quote.
Correct. Brilliant. Whoever said that has to be a genius. Yeah, that's right. So at the Bush Center, we're defending free enterprise. Part of it being a free people requires an economic system that frees the talents of the individual and a defense of the market. You know, one of the deformative experiences of my life was to go to China to visit mother and dad in 1975, where there was no consumer demand. Witness the fact that everybody wore the same outfit. In other words, you had a little group of people deciding, you look beautiful in gray, and so does everybody else. And I go back to China and consumer demand has in the marketplace are flourishing, and there's like bright colors, and it was unbelievable contrast. I happen to believe freedom in the marketplace is one of the freest forms of possible, where the collective demand of individuals decides that which is produced, as opposed to a handful of people.
So let me ask you a question on that in that regard.
Yeah.
Soviet Union,
right?
Cold War ends, and under Yeltsin, they move very quickly to democracy,
right?
And their economy falls apart. China,
yeah.
Deng Xiaoping starts his work in 1979, and they open up slowly but pretty quickly to free markets,
right?
And they have transformed the country, but it remains a one-party state.
So far.
Well, okay, that's the question. So who got it right? And should we give the Chinese a lot of credit, because economic freedom is, after all, a form of freedom?
I'm sure you've got scholars at Hoover analyzing the Russian model. As a matter of fact, I think you do.
We do.
And so you ought to probably relate to their conclusion, since I don't pretend to be a scholar. On the other hand, I did witness decision by some to enable a handful of people to exploit Russian assets, which created a lot of angst amongst the leadership, and anger people wondering in Russia, you know, why so-and-so got the benefit. And then I saw those people start flexing their muscle and the state pushing back. And that stood in contrast to what you described in China, and that is the marketplace beginning to flourish. It has a lot of problems, of course. I mean, during my presidency, I had to deal with intellectual property rights and, you know, people obeying rules, international trading rules and stuff. But I also recognized during that period of time the Christian church, for example, has flourished. Now, it's underground, admittedly, but there's a lot. Some of whom we're working with at the Bush Center through our Freedom Initiative.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. And I mean, obviously, there are two different decisions made about the same period of time that have led to different consequences. One is the state has become more powerful in Russia. The state is becoming less powerful in China.
Right. So property rights, free market, all of this. In other words, when the Bush Institute talks about human freedom, it's not some sort of naive notion, hold elections and you're done.
No, not at all. I mean, elections are an important step, but there has to be civil society behind it. There has to be market-based economics to help the free people, politically free people, realize their full potential. So we're big defenders of free enterprise. We're big defenders of, healthy societies, educated society, and educated societies as well. Freedom is kind of the cornerstone of the Institute. Now, here's the thing that you got to understand about these deals. If they're personality-based, in other words, this is all about me, they fail over time. I mean, I'm still a fresh memory. I've been out of presidency for 3 years. But 20 years from now, I'll be just a name. And a number, 43. I'll have had a record. I would have had to deal with, 9/11 and the financial meltdown. But people will long forget, what 043 was like. But they'll never forget, I hope. And one of our purposes is to remind people that freedom is universal, that it's a universal right. And it's not granted by the United States, I happen to believe it is a divine grant, but however it's granted, it's universal. And that free markets are the best way for people to become prosperous. Or that good education systems are necessary for free societies to thrive. And so those principles, when defended through action programs in our case, but through writings in your case at Hoover, far outlast the individual. And that's why the Bush Institute will be enduring.
So, for example, Iraq's in pretty good shape. Here's my argument. I'm just testing this. It's occurring to me for the first time. So if I get this wrong, just kick me right in the backside.
Right.
But Iraq, as best I can tell, Americans aren't all that popular in Iraq. They were happy to see it. That's complicated, but they were happy to see us go when we left. But under John Taylor, your Undersecretary of the Treasury, new currency.
Yeah.
Property rights that were fairly well established under existing law, and the law was simply begun to be administered fairly and justly again.
Yeah.
The Kurds got away quickly with they've invented or had underlying a reality of a kind of two-party system right away. So you've got this political system, elections are working, property rights are working, there are markets now which are extracting. It works. Basically, it works.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm not surprised.
You're not surprised?
No. People want to be free. I mean, kind of implicit, I know this isn't your question, it had to be planted by somebody else, because implicit in the question is kind of this near snobbery that basically says if you don't look like me or worship like me, you can't be free. There's kind of a surprise that people different from us are making the difficult choices for free society. Surely there's a long way to go, but the road to democracy is itself unbelievably bumpy and difficult. I mean, Gandhi's relatives were enslaved 100 years here. And so there needs to be a patience and a firm belief that people, regardless of whether they're like Americans or not, want to live in a free society, and an understanding that only free societies yield the peace. So, like, if we're in an ideological war, which I think we are, that the only way for there to be lasting peace is for there to be free societies, which ends up marginalizing the ideology of hate. But it's a hard path. And it, by the way, what I've just described to you is going to be defended at the Bush Institute, but it is a different foreign policy from the past, which was one that said what mattered to U.S. interests was a stable region.
Right.
But on 9/11, stability didn't work.
Right.
And so we're going to actively advance freedom way after I leave, depart the earthly. The earthly shackles.
You're looking pretty healthy.
Feeling pretty healthy. Yeah, feeling pretty good.
Okay, so the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
You introducing one of these conferences on freedom.
Yeah.
Two quotes. This is pretty interesting to me. First of all, two quotations. Your second inaugural address, quote, "The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands."
Correct.
That may be the central line from that speech.
Right. The other one, of course, was that, you know, I have to paraphrase, but where we see tyranny, we got to resist it.
Right, right. President George W. Bush opening the Bush Institute's conference on the wave of freedom, early lessons from the Middle East in May of last year, quote, "One of the dangers for the freedom movement around the world is that the United States grows weary."
Yeah.
We've had enough. Yeah. We have had enough.
Correct.
And that concerns you.
Well, what concerns me is isolationism. And there's been a tendency in our country to become isolationist.
Over and over again.
Yeah, over and over again. And you hear it. I mean, you know, it's too hard or, you know, do we really care? I mean, it's like you said on PEPFAR, and you're right. People said, you know, what interest is it of ours to spend taxpayers' money to save lives for people who we'll never know? And the interest is that we become a better nation, in this case, when we defend human life. Mm-hmm. And it also happens to be in our interest, in my judgment. Mm-hmm. But it's the same thing about freedom movements. And we're concerned at the Bush Institute that the country will say it doesn't matter whether a society is free or not. And our argument is it matters a lot to our own self-interest and our national interests, and therefore, to the extent we can, we will put programs in place that advance freedom and work with people that remind our country that that our isolationist past led to dire results.
Okay. The Egyptians are giving us a case study.
Yeah.
In democracy, in the absence of property rights, due process, what do you do? All right. Great Islamic scholar, Bernard Lewis.
Yes, fine man, by the way.
Amazing man.
Yeah, amazing man.
And by the way, he's 91 or 92 and going strong.
Good.
So you could be running this Bush Institute for years to come.
Well, that'd be 25 more. That'd be good.
There you go.
Quarter of a century.
So this is Bernard Lewis in February 2011. Quote, "I don't know how one could get the impression that the Muslim Brotherhood is benign. In genuinely fair and free elections, the Muslim parties are very likely to win, and I think that would be a disaster." Close quote. In Egypt, in the presidential election, mm-hmm. the candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood has now won.
Correct, 51-49.
Disaster?
And I think democracy is never a disaster. The disaster, of course, is that people would suspend or forego the institutions that are required for democracy to thrive and go back to the era where people's voices didn't matter. In other words, one of the things that we ought to be insisting upon, we the free world, is that there be certain elections. In other words, 4 years from now, whatever, I don't know whatever the term is, but there ought to be certainty that the people then get to go to the ballot box to decide whether or not the current winner fulfilled his promises.
Right.
So I think people ought to investigate carefully the promises made and then help enable the Egyptian people to hold people to account for either meeting the promises or not.
So more democracy, not less.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you'd say...
So the United States ought not to be in a position to say, okay, we're for elections just as long as the guy we want to win wins. What we ought to be saying is that we're for elections and give the people a chance to express themselves. I haven't studied the platforms of these candidates, but I bet They're mainly about improving the lives of their fellow citizens. War doesn't improve the lives of their citizens. I doubt you're going to see a candidate say, please vote for me. I promise you conflict and bloodshed.
Right, right.
The people say, wait, we're not interested in you. I do know something about the elections that took place in Gaza. I was insistent upon elections because I believe that the democracy is the only way for there to be peace. And, the idea of two democratic states living side by side, in my judgment, was a strategic vision that would best lead to peace. But you can't have a democracy in Gaza or the West Bank without elections.
Right.
And the institutions that proceed and follow elections, civil society. So Hamas wins, right? But look at the platform is what I would tell people. It was better education, better social services. And by the way, we're sick and tired of a political system that produced people like Arafat that turns out was there for his own self-interest, not the interest of peace. Well, Hamas wins. And then militant Hamas takes over, kicks out the reasonables, and I don't think Hamas will get much of a vote in Gaza now that the leadership has failed the people. And my only point is that there needs to be certainty in elections, and that at the same time we ought to be helping build civil society. This is why Laura and I are involved with helping Egyptian women, because we believe women will lead the democracy movement in the Middle East, and we want women to have the mentors, U.S. mentors. We want them to understand how best to develop civil society, though with Egyptian flavor to it.
Right.
We want them to attract other women to their cause to provide solace and comfort and strength. And so this is our contribution to the democracy movement.
So whatever else the United States, you left office a while ago, but whatever else the State Department ought to be saying to Egypt right now, it ought not to be saying to the military, shut this thing down. On the contrary, it ought to be saying, you do what you need to do to secure the country, but more democracy, not less.
Yeah, look, the people went to Tahrir Square because they don't like a system that was shut down.
Right.
They had to live in a system that shut them out for a long period of time. And that I think it's, you know, really important that we stand by the principle that when the voices are heard, peace is yielded over time. And look, one of my favorite stories about my presidency is my relationship with the Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi. And so he calls me on September the 12th. You know, we're with you, man, shoulder to shoulder. And we'll work to spread freedom as the alternative to the ideologues. I mean, he saw it.
He saw it right away.
Absolutely. And what made the call unbelievably ironic is my father fought him. And this guy didn't go to college so that he could become a bomber pilot to bomb the Japanese. And now the sons are keeping the peace. You got to ask the question, why? You know, what happened? It wasn't inevitable that the United States and Japan become friends. And I ascribe that phone call mainly to the fact that Japan adopts a Japanese-style democracy where the people get to decide the fate of their government. And same thing that'll happen in the Middle East. And the Bush Center Institute wants to be involved with that process and as best as we can.
Back to the 4% growth.
Yeah. You kind of got diverted there.
No. Nice program. Diversion. I'm not going to stop you.
That's your program.
Handful of quotations.
Yeah.
President George W. Bush, quote, I had to abandon free market principles in order to save the free market system. This is in the Rose Garden when things were bad.
Yeah.
Senator Barack Obama, at the time the president-elect, not too long after you made your comment. Quote, everybody knows we're in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, close quote. Final quotation, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan testifying to Congress in the autumn of 2008, quote, this crisis has turned out to be broader than anything I could have imagined. The wise man of Washington.
Yeah.
Those of us who look to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, that is, those of us who suppose the free markets would work, are in a state of shocked disbelief. Close mm-hmm. quote. Okay, so something big happened.
Yes.
And it's pretty hard to talk about getting back to 4% growth unless we understand what it was.
Yeah.
And do you feel that we understand yet quite what happened? I'll be honest with you. I don't. I haven't heard an explanation that strikes me as comprehensive, explains all of the
forces. No, I think it's going to be, I think, you know, it'll take a while to sort it all out. No question there was a lot of liquidity in our system. In other words, we're the most attractive place for people to invest. A lot of money coming from overseas, and people started inventing products. And at the meantime,
financial products.
Yeah, financial products. Right. And it seemed like a safe bet would be housing markets. But the housing market became overinflated. A bubble was created, partly because Congress refused, I'm not going to be a little self-serving here, refused to respond to the demands of President George W. Bush to reform Fannie and Freddie.
Right.
So you had liquidity pouring in, a bubble being created in the mortgage market, and instruments kind of taking advantage of what seemed to be a bubble that wouldn't pop. And it popped. And so your president, you've campaigned on the market. He said, look, bad decisions ought to be sorted out by the marketplace. People ought to pay for a bad decision. And I'm told that, you know, it's a good chance you'll be overseeing a depression. And the nature of the presidency is such that you got a stark choice to make. Do you gamble and hope we don't go into a depression? Or do you say, what? Let's do the best we can to stop a depression. I chose the latter. I didn't want history to say Bush could have done something about 21% unemployment and didn't.
Right.
And so I made a painful decision.
Bush real, to economy dropped dead.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
It's painful, man. I came from Midland, Texas. My pals out in Midland, I knew what they'd be saying in the coffee shop.
And they did say it.
Yeah, loudly. What happened to him? You know? But I decided, and I would make the same decision, because people forget. The interesting thing about history is people forget. They forget what the mood in the country was after 9/11, when there was threat after threat after threat. They forget that Congress overwhelmingly backed me to remove Saddam Hussein, both Republicans and Democrats. And they forget that in the fall of 2008, there was a liquidity crisis, the likes of which we have not seen in a long time. Now, I know you're an expert on the TED spread, but I wasn't. But the TED spread is a measurement of liquidity, and I became an expert on the TED spread as I watched the TED spread say, day after day after day, capital's not moving.
Right.
And so I decided to do something about it, and moved as best as we could. Now, the thing about, interesting, Peter, I can't prove to you that my decision prevented the depression. I can just tell you we didn't have one. And you know, that's the nature of the job, though. The nature of the job is you got to make decisions that you know will be unpopular, but you think are right. And you take your hits, you know. That's just what happens.
Amity Schlaes, you mentioned people forget. Amity Schlaes is the director of the 4% Growth Program.
Awesome person.
Oh, is she ever. And she, have you looked at her new book yet?
Well, it's interesting you pitched it, because you took the words out of my mouth. I had two intentions, one to pitch my own called Decision Points and hers on Coolidge.
See, I've pre-ordered it on Amazon.
I read Forgotten Man.
Oh, great book.
Really good book.
Really good book. Really good
anyway,
book.
Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, so now Amity owes us both.
Yeah.
But I was looking over, Amity gave a speech at your conference in New York, the 4% Growth Project, and she talked about the Kennedy tax cuts and how successful those were.
Yeah.
So here's what we know. Coolidge, his secretary, they're usually called the Mellon tax cuts because Andrew Mellon was Treasury Secretary at the time, but President Coolidge cuts taxes and we get years of prosperity. Mm-hmm. John Kennedy proposes tax cuts, Lyndon Johnson enacts them, and the economy takes off. Ronald Reagan cuts taxes and we get 25 years of economic expansion with only a couple of very, very minor recessions in that long period of growth. So you would think, wouldn't you, that if democracy were...
Well, let me correct the record.
Go ahead.
George Bush cuts taxes and has over 35 months of continuous strong growth.
And George Bush later says, quote, I wish they weren't called the Bush tax cuts. Explain that one.
That's a little of my mother in me. because if they weren't called the Bush, the implication was that they had been made permanent. Right. If they'd been somebody else's tax cuts, we wouldn't have been having a debate on whether they should expire or not. That's what that meant. No, I'm proud of him. Look, I mean, I wasn't running away from him. I was basically saying, I was being modest, false modesty.
Okay.
Which obviously didn't work.
But the point is, small government, the lowest possible tax rates,
yeah.
This works. American history through the 20th century has proven again and again and again that it works.
Yeah.
And yet here we sit with the chief executive of the United States saying, we need more government, we need higher taxes, we need the rich to pay their fair share, which is another way. So do you ever despair sometimes of democracy, of our ability to learn as a nation?
So let's see, implied in your question is, am I for a form of government other than democracy? No, not at all.
That's what elections are all about. You cut to the bottom a little faster than I was hoping.
Well, that's what elections are all about. I mean, you know, don't forget 2010. You know what, speaking about elections, let me talk about 2006. One of the interesting things I observed is power can be very corrupting. And the 2006 elections were not about Iraq. They were about the failure of Congress to, for example, reform Social Security. Mm-hmm. And I say corrupting, not in a money sense. I mean, a lot of times Congress basically says, I don't want to do this because I might not get reelected. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
And so the big problems facing us right now are what's required to grow the private sector, and will we have the political courage to deal with the unfunded liabilities inherent in the entitlement programs? And so if you ask about private sector growth, this is what we're doing at the Bush Center, for example. You got to focus on a couple of things. One, small businesses, since they create most new jobs. The current income tax code is... by raising income taxes, by the way, you affect small business growth because most small businesses pay tax under the income tax, personal income tax. People don't know that, but most small businesses are subchapter S's or limited partnerships. So you run up the top rate, you're affecting the majority of the job creators. In the 4% growth book, we talk about the need for trade. We talk about the need for reasonable immigration policy.
This is a book that will be published in July.
In July, yeah, mm-hmm. And another book to tout. And anyway, written by, not by me, written by people with a lot more credibility than I have, like Nobel Prize winning economists. So this is our action plan. Remember I told you we're action oriented.
Right.
It's one thing to hold a conference, and those are good, but it's more important to produce results. And one of the results is this book that we hope people pay attention to. And it's a belief that the private sector can grow a lot more robustly than it's growing, and the aspirational goal is 4% growth. And tax policy, obviously, is an important part of growing the economy by 4%. And you're right. That's the debate for 2012 off is basically more government versus less government.
Military service. The Bush Institute is dedicated to, quote, serving and honoring those who risk their lives to extend freedom to others. Now, as I understand it, a big part of this program is just your leading by example by spending a lot of your time with vets.
Yeah, so far.
So right. Far.
We want to be more added value than that. I mean, so for example, one of the things we're beginning to explore is it possible to develop a set of standards to determine, for others to determine whether or not the NGO to which they're contributing is results oriented? In other words, is it doing the job it should do? But right now, in order to honor our vets, I'm riding my bikes and sponsoring.
Well, you had a 100K bike ride up in Amarillo this past spring.
With a 62-mile bike ride is awesome, unbelievably awesome. First of all, mountain biking is a thrill, and to ride with vets who are dealing with severe injury, whether they be mental or physical, is a fantastic experience. So I'll tell you a story for your listeners. I mean, I don't need, your listeners probably understand how great America is. I hope they do. It's an awesome country. And by the way, how awesome is it a country where taxpayers contribute to save the lives of total strangers, like in Africa, or for young men and women to go liberate 50 million people so they have a chance to live in peace while we're defending our own security? It's an awesome country. And so Gade, Major Gade, professor at West Point, one of the writers, tells a story about when he came home from the hospital. He's in a wheelchair, really blown up, to the point where he completely lost his right leg. And his little girl says, Daddy, would you play Legos with me? And Gade says, I can't. And she says, my daddy can't do anything. And Gade tells a room full of Texans at this bike ride, that is when, Mr. President, I decided I could do everything including riding bikes with you. The thing that's interesting about Gade is that there's no prosthesis that would work for bike riding. So he rode 100 kilometers on one leg. We're a great country that produces people like Gade.
Military service. This takes me back to a conversation I had when you were in office with David Chu.
Yeah.
Who was your Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel.
I remember him.
Okay. This is something that's been on my mind ever since, and I can't think my way through it. Maybe you can. And we were talking about trying to get ROTC programs expanded up in the Northeast. And David Chu said, well, there's a problem in certain regions in the country. The Northeast may be the most dramatic because during base closings, those were the oldest bases up in the Northeast. The Northeast was disproportionately hard hit by base closings. You've got a lot of fancy schools up there. Your Yale, Harvard, my Dartmouth. And it turns out you've got very, very minor ROTC participation. Yale just took ROTC back, I believe it was last year, but hadn't had it for years. And so David Chu said there is a danger that an entire region of the country is drifting away from any contact with military culture at all. Mm-hmm. And I just to try to get a feel for it here, I looked at, turns out that in recent years, some 10% of Ivy League graduates, I don't want to make too much of the Ivy League, but it's a point. They're up in the Northeast.
You're making a lot of it during this discussion.
10% of Ivy League grads apply to Teach for America.
Yeah.
Way under 1% are going into ROTC programs.
Yeah.
So Texas is Texas.
Yeah.
Southwest is the Southwest.
Yeah.
But is there a way to address this regional imbalance?
Please take this answer for in the spirit in which it's given, which is conciliatory to you. But just because Ivy Leaguers don't go to the military doesn't mean people up east aren't. I go to in Maine, I go up to Portland for a picnic honoring families of the fallen, and it's packed, not only with grieving family members, but with the people that served alongside those who were killed in combat. I mean, we've got volunteers from all over the country, including up east. That's what we say down here in Texas, up east.
Up east, gotcha.
But no, I'm not worried about it. The respect for our military and our vets is overwhelming throughout the entire country. And this stands in stark contrast to the Vietnam era, where veterans were disrespected and felt it, but it's changed a lot, and I hope that the country's respect for our current veterans says to those veterans of, say, Korea or Vietnam, that we respect you too, and I think the veterans are beginning to feel that.
Last couple of questions.
Sure.
Soaring deficit.
Yeah.
Slow economic growth, the lowest labor force participation in many years. Politics very bitter. Edward Luce, who served for 4 years as the Washington bureau chief of the Financial Times, published a book this past spring called "Time to Start Thinking: America in an Age of Dissent." Political science. I like. Okay, you're answering already. Political scientists and longtime Washington observers Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann have also published a book this past spring. Their title: "It's Even Worse Than It Looks." So, Henry Luce, editor of Time magazine, right after the Second World War, wrote a famous essay in which he called the 20th century the American century.
Yeah.
And the question is,
the 21st?
You got it.
Yes. We're the most productive nation. We're the most innovative nation. We got a great higher education system. We got a lot going for us. And no doubt in my mind that we'll recover from where we are, and that the United States will continue to be the economic leader and hopefully the a leader in just causes. And we've been through days of malaise before. There's nothing wrong with it, but I'm not a part of the The Hand Wringers About America.
Two last questions. You're known as a very avid reader of history. What have you got on your bookside table these days?
I am reading a history of Joe DiMaggio's hit streak.
Really?
Yeah, that's good. I have got on my... We don't have book stands anymore. We've got iPads.
Okay.
Wait, please.
I'm a little behind on that stuff.
Yeah, okay. You're kind of stuck. Right. Anyway, The Great Debate, compromise of Henry Clay forged right before the Civil War. I'm looking forward to reading a book that was just given by a fine book critic on the Alamo. I believe you just gave me that.
I did just give you that.
But I am reading, I'm still reading quite a bit and enjoy it a lot.
Okay. Last question, promise. This really will be the last question. I've lived in California 20 years.
Yeah.
I come to Texas. And there is something about this place. The flags you see people flying from their homes, the sense of openness. And yet, I do notice that your mom and dad spend their summers up in Kennebunkport.
Yeah.
It gets warm down. He's at 103 degrees outside right now.
Yeah.
And you go on vacation, and you leave Dallas for Crawford. You don't leave Texas. You go deeper into Texas.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's Texas mean to you?
You know, I tell people... my dad bequeathed me three great gifts. An awesome name and unconditional love. No money. And being raised initially in West Texas and then in other parts of the state. A Texan is somebody who's got a attitude that is... a little different, it seems like to me. It's a can-do attitude. It's a very entrepreneurial state. There's a culture here which, if you come from like California, if you're fortunate enough to move here, you'd become a Texan faster than you could possibly imagine, because we got a very strong culture. It means a lot to be a Texan. There was no doubt in my mind, and no doubt in Laura's mind, that we'd be coming home to Texas. We love it here. We're comfortable here. We got a lot of friends here. This state is doing very well. Some of it has to do with our natural resources, but a lot of it has to do with limited government. We don't have an income tax. Do you know the Texas legislature, the second biggest state in the union, meets 4 months out of every 2 years, which meant being the governor was awesome. But it's, it's unbelievable, isn't it, that we can get our budgets done and get the state's business done, and send people home to be less of a politician and more of a citizen. And so we've got not only an attitude, but we've got a structure that supports the attitude. And it's a great place. I'm honored you're here. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Yeah.
George W. Bush, 43rd President of the United States. Thank you for joining
us. Yes, sir, Peter.
In Dallas, for Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson. We'll